Well, thanks very much for this.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, what I wanted to do was just sort of take a few minutes and kind of walk through your career, you know, from then until now. And I kind of want to start with, you know, you had these musical parents. Your dad played music. Your mom was a showgirl of sorts.
No, grandma.
Or grandmother. Is that something that you kind of leaned towards when you were a kid? Did you feel that performing was something that was going to be in your future? Or was that just something that was around the house and you weren't sure?
Well, I always wanted to sing, and I wasn't very good at other kinds of jobs as time went by. So I think that I always got fired at straight jobs, so that kind of helped push me toward, you know, music. You know, it's hard to answer that question because when you're a little kid, anything is possible. So I could have been a musician, or I could have been an athlete, or I could have anywhere would have called me equally. But as I got older, I guess there was a passion for music. So I was lucky that I was able to get paid to do it.
Can you just sort of help us paint the picture of what that L.A. music scene was like in the late 70s, either right before that first album or right after, you know, you, Tom Waits, Lowell George, Linda? I mean, just that scene that seems so iconic as we look back from today, because it was so important to what came later. Can you just sort of paint the picture of what that was like for you?
Well, the California, you know, the people who become the icons of the California country rock, I guess, lived mostly in Topanga Canyon. They were Linda Ronstadt and all the stuff that developed around her, including the Eagles. Lowell George lived up there. Little Feat was a pretty beloved, authentic kind of R&B band, and the players were so respected, and Jackson Browne, and that was kind of the hierarchy. Down below the mountain on Santa Monica Boulevard was another thing going on, headed mostly by, I think it was really just Tom Waits, but he was invited to participate in that Southern California group, in that, you know, the Eagles recorded one of his songs, Old 55, and he was friends with Bette Midler, so he was on the outside of that group. When I came along, I could never have been one of them because I was just a really different kind of creature altogether. But Lowell came and listened to Easy, but I was a good songwriter, you know, but as far as being a performer, I was also 10 years younger than most of them, or, you know, it's hard to say what generation I was in. I was identified with other people, but I was not of the, you know, in 1969, I was 14. I think I was the last of my kind, like the last of the singer-songwriters of that generation. I think that's kind of how I'm seen, as opposed to the first of the new thing.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, I do, but you bring up a point that I hadn't thought of, that there were sort of two different camps in that L.A. scene in the late 70s. Those that were up in the mountains, you know, like the Joanies, et cetera, but those that were down on the street, like Tom Waits, and in the clubs at 2 a.m. I shouldn't say clubs, in the bars at 2 a.m., you know.
Exactly. In the parking lot.
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, a good friend of mine gave me Tom's album Small Change when I was 16 years old. And that sound of Tom, I would not have equated with the Southern California sound of, say, the Eagles at the time, you know, even though they recorded Old 55. You know, it's good for you to tell me of that perspective of two different camps in the same city at the same time and not that far apart, just down the hill.
Yeah, well, Tom was doing that. You know, Tom was flicking his hair back and wearing Roach stickers. He modeled himself and was authentically of a totally different literary category. It'd be like, you know, Ayn Rand versus F. Scott Fitzgerald or something. It was just they're both in the library, but they don't have much to do with each other. I'd say that, you know, but Tom is a very friendly, you know, a likable person. So anybody who met him would, you know, it wasn't like he was off-putting. So he would have been able to move in and out of any group of people with ease. Even though he looked different, he was a serious writer. you know, you couldn't have put Tom Waits on the stage with Linda Ronstadt.
I don't think so. I want to ask you about somebody else that you worked with who left us not long ago, Walter Becker, who produced Flying Cowboys for you. I just want to ask you if you would just sort of talk about Walter and kind of what he brought to your sound or what he brought out in your sound when he worked with you.
Well, that's deep water because it's such a personal relationship. He spent 9 months with me, so his impact on my life right after I had a child is where I go, as opposed to how he impacted the sound. But Walter was a more meticulous person than I am, especially when it came to music. I'm more of a improvisational, let it be. He's more of a take it apart and make it perfect. So we had a little trouble. And I think that Satellites was a, I think it was a popular song, but it was also kind of influential. You know, Dave Matthews' band kind of comes out of that song. He wrote his own Satellites. He's got a soprano sax. I think that song has, you know, and it wasn't my favorite at all. I didn't like the soprano sax. I hated that soprano sax. Mm. But we argued about it, and I let him make those choices. So I think that... one of the things I learned is that maybe people like me in a setting that I don't particularly like. And that's been a difficult thing for me because this is business, but it's also my art. So which way do I go? Do I, you know, hire people and play it the way you heard it on the record and make you happy? I like to make you happy, but I'll go off stage and cry because it'll be killing me to replicate what was already done. Great. The thing about music is it's alive. I want to make it alive every single time I play it. So Steely Dan, who are some of my favorite bands, but I could never play a song the same way every night. And they do.
Yeah.
Same way every night, and people love it. So it's a really different, you know, in this case, I guess I am a jazz musician. It's a very, very old use of the word. I like it as a living thing. I want to see what happens tonight if we don't play the bass there. That keeps me interested in what I do, but it certainly has made me marginalized in the pop world.
Well, you make me think of Bob Dylan and what Dylan does with his own music.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, and how he changes it up almost, you know, sometimes night to night.
Uh-huh. Good.
You know, you've dealt with writer's block once or twice, you know, in your long, long career. You know, how have you dealt with that? Where do you just sort of let it happen because it's very organic and natural? Or do you try to fight through that for people who have their own creative outlets, whether they're writers or singers or maybe even just parents? You know, and sometimes you get to a point where you're a parent and you don't want to be a parent today, but you have to. You know, how do you handle those types of challenges?
Well, I come from a kind of Midwestern mother who just took care of it, whatever it was. We got to pull the dead horse down the block today. We're going to pull the horse down the block. So I don't have any sense of can't do it. So the writer's block is... It's not like I don't feel like driving the car. Writer's block is, you know, writing is an expression of my joy and happiness. So when I can no longer write, somehow I've become consumed by this world here, right? This daily life. And I think it happened to me when my daughter was 10, 9, 10, 11. She wasn't having the best time in school. And then I was also having a terrible love affair. And these personal things just shut me down. I was not interested in writing. I had nothing to say. I couldn't pick up a pen. I couldn't imagine finding that sea of serenity where you look out and you go, oh, look at the bird. I'm going to write a beautiful thing about a bird, right? How its wing is on the wind, the music of its wing. Nothing like that was coming. And I guess because I always took a long time between records, nobody particularly noticed until I mentioned it in an interview. I'm hearing about it now, but I overcame it by practice. I just sat down and made myself remember what it was like to write. And what I learned is that I can always write. I'm always writing. I could write songs all day long. I limit myself from writing either because I'm superstitious and think if I wait, I'll gather the magical stuff. It'll be more powerful if I don't write every day. I'm not really sure. Or it's so wonderful to write a song that I don't allow myself to have that pleasure all the time. I don't really understand my unconscious, but when I overcame it, I decided that I would not ever let that muscle atrophy again. That's a long answer, but I don't think it's applicable to, I don't feel like being a parent. I don't feel like making the bed today because those are responsibilities. But writing is almost like breathing to a professional writer. It should be, it is as natural as anything else you do. And when it stops, and it's okay if you're done. I just thought, I've said all I have to say, you know? And there's so much pressure to keep on doing what you did. It might have been a kind of existential conundrum. Do I want to continue to be this? So I'll just stop writing and see who I am when I don't do it. Who knows, you know?
I don't care how long it is. That's an answer from the heart, and that's what's important to me. Do I have it right that you're living in New Orleans these days?
I am, and I'm not. I've been here in L.A. finishing a book, trying to finish this book, and I came here to do it, so I should be going back there in the fall.
Has the music of New Orleans, the feel of New Orleans, made its way into your work yet?
I think so, yeah. I think it does. It's a pretty happy music.
It's a unique part of the country.
I tend to write non-rhythmic things. My happy place is just sounds of chords running over you and what I have to say. And so rhythm is a second thought. And I like being there because it there's rhythm everywhere. So it's a thing I need to learn, understand. Yeah, and there's music everywhere.
Is the book that you're writing, is that the autobiography? I thought that already came out on you.
No, it didn't.
It didn't. So you had the documentary a couple of years ago, The Other Side of Desire. You're writing the autobiography now. What does it feel like kind of being under the microscope as you look back on your life with the combination of the doc and the book that you're writing?
I'm not under it yet. When you get to read it, I'll be under it. Right now, I'm the only one looking at it. And it's been... You know, the two things I've contended with is my writing style and then what I've learned about my life by looking at it on pieces of paper. And that's been pretty important, I think. And a lot of acceptance of people. And I, in spite of a kind of Charles Dickens life, I have to say that I feel pretty happy about it. It is and was an incredible life. It was a life turned up loud. It was a life with a larger palette of light than most. And, I come from a violent and emotional family, and I love them. They're the ones I was given, and I love them.
So I'm guessing that you label your life as a Dickens story, as in best of times, worst of times?
Yes, exactly.
That's what I figured. You know, about 16 years ago or so, you released a live album that was recorded here in Colorado at Red Rocks. If I remember right, I mean, Chuck was from Denver. I'm going to guess that you have a bit of a Colorado history. You know, any memories, thoughts, good times about Colorado that you can tell us?
Be very little one. My first show on tour was in Colorado.
Do you remember where?
You know, I don't think it was the Bluebird Theater. I played there quite a bit later, but I can't say for sure that my first show was there.
Well, Ricky, I know you're coming back to Colorado. You're going to create some new memories at the Boulder Theater. August 2nd is the show. Ricky, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and I hope that you have a great show when you get here.
I appreciate you calling me up and keeping my name out there.
Thanks very much, Ricky.